listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. Olivia Lang explores the connection between creativity and alcohol in the lives and work of sixth grade American writers. F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, John Berryman, Tennessee Williams, Raymond Carver, and John Cheever, all of whom were alcoholics. Her book, The Trip to Echo Springs on Writers and Drinking, examines how drinking is portrayed in their work and the troubles and chaos it caused in their lives. It's published by Picador, and I'm glad it brings Olivia Lang to our show. Hello, Olivia.
Hi.
First of all, I have to ask you, six great American writers, all of whom are alcoholics, how did you whittle it down to six? Because there's so many American writers who are both great and alcoholic, and some you had to leave off the list. Why these six?
There are so many, it's true. And they're not even necessarily just American. There are so many great British authors who had drinking problems, like Kingsley Amis.
Mm-hmm. Whose ex-wife I saw just passed away.
Yeah, Elizabeth Jane Howard, mm-hmm. who in her own right is the most extraordinary writer, actually. I'm a real fan of her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Kingsley Amis was an appalling drunk, although a very funny writer.
But let's actually stop for a moment with Kingsley Amis, because I remember he wrote, of course, a lot about drinking, usually in a very positive way.
He was very unrepentant.
He wrote a lot of books about his favorite cocktails and things like that. But I remember once, I think it was in his memoir, which came out, you know, I don't know, 30 years ago, 25, 30 years ago. And he, I think it was there where he was drawing a contrast between the kind of drinking that he did and the kind of drinking that American writers did. And I know that every alcoholic supposedly has a favorite alcoholic. They like to have one alcoholic who behaves worse than they do, so they feel better about their drinking. But the distinction he drew was that he said he never drank while writing. He said that he would maybe, while he was editing his pages at the end of the day, he would maybe have a cocktail just to kind of, you know, wind down for the day. But he said American writers and a lot of the people on your list would drink and write simultaneously. Do you think that's a bogus distinction, or is there something about American writers, there was something kind of like, yeah, I'm a man, I'm going to drink and I'm going to write, I can do it all
I think that is really quite bogus. Kingsley Amis is a terrible liar. But I think, first of all, I don't totally believe that he didn't sometimes write drunk. Mm-hmm. I'm not convinced that at the sort of saturated stage of his drinking that he wasn't writing some then.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, this is the kind of myth we have about writing and drinking. You know, they're sitting at their typewriter, they have the glass of bourbon, they're knocking it back, they get inspired and they start writing away.
Mm-hmm.
It really isn't actually that common. I can think of William Faulkner probably did it. I mm-hmm. imagine Jack Kerouac did it. Fitzgerald sometimes had to do it, he claimed. He wrote a lot of Tender as the Night Drunk, and that was because he was under enormous stress, but he didn't particularly like doing it. Aside from that, it tends not to be writing drunk. It tends to be that the drinking happens after the writing of the day is done. So somebody like Ernest Hemingway, somebody like Tennessee Williams, get up very early in the morning, this very sort of focused routine, black coffee, sit down, write the pages. And it's then, in the sort of slack time of the afternoon, that the drinking really starts. So that sort of, I know what he's getting at, Kingsley Amis, by saying that, because mm-hmm. it is the classic thing of they can't control their drinking. I, on the other hand, can control my drinking.
Right.
But no, it's more complicated than that, I think.
The only other drinker I can think, I mean, there are so many writers who drink, which is something I want to ask you about, why that's the case. But I remember reading in Stephen King's book about writing, he talked about writing, I think it was Cujo, and he said that he really wished he had been sober when he wrote it, because it's a good book and he would have enjoyed remembering what it was like to write it. So he was actually somebody who could...
He did write drunk, yeah.
And he could function as a writer, at least, very well, but that's the exception rather than the rule.
And also, he stopped at a fairly early point in
right.
his career, or at least mid-career.
Right.
God knows what kind of books Stephen King would have been writing if he'd carried on drinking till now,
right.
if he even would have had a career.
Right. Why is this, especially, and I know it's true in other cultures, but what is this pathology about American writers and drinking? Why does it seem to be such an American thing?
That is a complicated question again. I think there is, and I'm specifically looking at men who drink. Women who drink is a whole different story, which has different answers to that. But I think with the male answer, a lot of it is to do with masculinity, machismo, something about these men who are extraordinarily sensitive, extraordinarily open, who are doing not a particularly manly job, sitting mm-hmm. there every day writing novels about love and, you know, all these things, but who want to maintain, and this is a 20th century story as well, let's remember, who want to maintain a certain kind of masculinity, a certain kind of masculine armour. And I think drinking is so much a part of that, and I think that's really the Hemingway story, is it's a way to maintain an appearance of being a hard man, a strong man, a tough man, while doing something that really is quite different from that as well, and while containing and concealing a much more sort of fragile, sensitive, depressed, anxious, all these other things are locked away inside, and alcohol makes a tremendous armour for that.
Mm-hmm. And of course, if you've got the role models of other writers who are hard drinkers, then that kind of becomes a perpetuating thing. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm talking to Olivia Lang, who's written a great new book. It's gotten great reviews everywhere. The Trip to Echo Springs on Writers and Drinking. It's out by Picador here at WNYC and WNYC.org. Let's start with John Cheever, because, if you read his diaries, it's just excruciating, because you just see this kind of torture chamber he was in because of drinking and trying to resist drinking.
Yeah.
And what role did drinking play as material for him in his writing? How did he use it in his stories?
It's very much present in his stories. It's his characters are often sort of similar to him. And what he is such an interesting character. He didn't come from a particularly grand background. He was not particularly wealthy. Really, his family were quite poor. They struggled for money a lot. He didn't feel especially loved by his family, by his mother or his father. He was a pretty troubled, very talented kid. And he decided that he needed to create this self for himself, this waspy Brooks Brothers tweed. The country squire. They call him the Squire of Ossining, don't they? That sort of impeccable exterior. And there's ways in which drink is a prop for that. He has the right drink at the right moment. He has his champagne. He has his lovely martinis when he comes home from work. It's a civilized aura, and drink helps to... It's a stage dressing almost.
Mm-hmm.
And it is other things too, which is it's a way for him to escape from himself. And for Cheever, aside from all of the other writers, his desire was for men. His sexual desire was to have relationships with men, and that didn't fit in with the Cheever image he'd created. It wasn't something he could accept about himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the drinking becomes a huge part of that, a way of sort of suppressing this secret self that he couldn't bear, he couldn't bring himself to acknowledge. So you asked how drink works in his stories, and I think drink works in just those sort of ways. It's partly addressing to the kind of characters that he's writing about, and it's partly a way of examining people's downfall. And this is why I look a lot in the book at the story The Swimmer, which is about a man very much like Cheever.
It's one of his more surreal stories.
It's
naturalistic
story.
And surreal at the same time, which is yeah. a strange kind of achievement.
Yeah, it seems.
Can you describe,
like,
for those who haven't read it? Because I know there was sort of a bad movie.
Oh, there's an amazing
with Burt Lancaster, wasn't it?
With Cheever in it. Cheever's in that movie.
Oh, is he in, like, the party?
There's a tiny scene, and he kisses a girl, and apparently Burt Lancaster never forgave him for kissing the girl he wasn't supposed to.
it's a really kind of ridiculous movie, but it was a bad idea to describe the story for us, just for people who haven't read it, because it is kind of amazing.
It's so wonderful. So it starts the morning after a party. Some people are around at a friend's house, and this is Neddy Merrill is the central character. And it starts by him saying, I've drunk too much. I drank too much last night. But he has this wonderful idea. He's going to swim home by way of all of his neighbours' swimming pools. He's going to join them together into this sort of secret river that he'll follow home. He's high on life. He's high on his fantastic plan. Off he goes in his swimming trunks. And he stops off at party after party, drinking a few more, going on another terrace, another few gins. And gradually you have this sense that something funny is happening with time. It's getting a bit slippery. It seems suddenly like we're not in summer anymore and we're maybe in autumn. The pools aren't so nice. Some of the houses are abandoned. Something odd is happening. And it ends with almost a wintry scene. And Neddy the encounters he's having at these parties start becoming much more toxic. There's clearly something very bad has happened in his life. He's lost all sorts of things. And it ends with him walking up the driveway of his own house, which is locked. Nobody lives there. He doesn't live there. And you feel like you've gone through years with him. It's only a few pages long. It's the most extraordinary story.
Pretty devastating.
Pretty devastating. Yeah. And he's a drunk. The whole thing is that he has drunk away this promise, this early promise. And it very much seems to me the Cheever story.
And although the Cheever story eventually becomes really a surprising one.
The early Cheever story,
story. Well, what's interesting about that story and a lot of his early stories is that there's this tremendous awareness of the disease he's in the grips of, and yet he's, he's completely powerless to do anything about it. But he's one of the only ones of this huge catalog of American alcoholic writers who actually cleaned up. What was his rebirth? How did that take place?
He literally, and this is a cliche that isn't always true, but with Cheever, he literally hit rock bottom. He was teaching at a university, and he was basically drinking himself to death, very near death. And his brother came and rescued him, got him out, and he went into rehab. And I think he just realized at that point that he was losing everything. He'd lost all his sense of himself. He couldn't write anymore. He had the cover on the typewriter all the time. It was covered in dust. And somehow he just found it in himself to get out, to get dry. So he went to what's now the Addiction Institute, but was then called Smithers, where Truman Capote also went, less successfully.
Yeah.
And he managed to get sober, and then he stayed sober. And what's amazing about that is he later developed cancer, and his doctors said, it's over, John, you can start drinking again. And he said, no, I'd rather die sober, thanks, which I find incredibly moving, actually, when you consider how powerful his addiction was, that he was up at 10 in the morning sneaking into the pantry and scooping down the gin, that at the end of his life he found that in himself. And he wrote an extraordinary book called Faulkner,
right,
which is the novel about recovery. It's about a heroin addict in prison, and he poured his sense of what had happened to him into that novel, and I think it's his best book.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm talking to Olivia Lang about her new book about American alcoholic writers. It's called The Trip to Echo Springs on Writers and Drinking. It's a great title, The Trip to Echo Springs. Can you give us the iconography behind that?
Where sure. That came from? So Echo Spring is a kind of bourbon. It's a Kentucky bourbon, which I've never drunk, actually. I must try and find a bottle. And in Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Brick, the drunkard character, the sports hero who's on crutches, he keeps saying to his wife, Maggie the cat, I'm making a little short trip to Echo Spring. And he literally means he's just hobbling to the liquor cabinet. Sometimes she takes his crutches away and then he has to crawl to the liquor cabinet. But that phrase really stuck with me because it seemed to catch something of a more symbolic sense of what people are trying to do when they're getting drunk. They're making a trip to Echo Spring. And I wanted to know where that place was metaphorically, symbolically, what was happening when somebody was repeatedly taking themselves out of daily life and into drunkenness, into intoxication.
And Tennessee Williams talked about this topic, about writers and alcoholism, in an interview in the Paris Review in 1981. What did he have to say on this? Was he he must have been one of your sources for, I don't know, for wisdom, denial, whatever. What did he have to say?
He was in denial at that stage. So he's like, everyone drinks. Writers always drink. It's a stressful life. It's tough, and my drinking now, it's got to be moderate. Mm-hmm. His drinking at that point was not moderate, and it's a kind of excuse note, I think. They're like, everyone else is doing it, so why can't I? It's this sort of constant desire to deny what's happening that I think is the first thing that has to be dropped when somebody's recovering, and that was something that Tennessee Williams never really managed to find in himself.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about Cheever hitting rock bottom and teaching, and there's actually a great scene in this book where John Cheever and Raymond Carver are both teaching together at Iowa. Seems like a terrible idea of programming. Somebody had maybe dug a little deeper, they wouldn't have paired those two. But they're like waiting at a liquor store at like 9 a.m. in the morning, waiting in a cold car for this liquor store to open up to buy vodka or whatever.
There's no waiting, though. That's the thing about it. So they're driving up in the car, and Raymond Carver's driving. It's a Ford Falcon. And John Cheever, who doesn't have any socks on, it's freezing. It's like yesterday was in New York. Very, very cold day. And John Cheever is out of the car before he's even stopped driving and running to the door. The clerk is there with the keys, turning them at 9 a.m. and he's straight in. And I mean, in some ways it's a funny story, and in some ways it's just not a funny story at all.
No, no. But and Raymond Carver, he eventually
got dry.
What was his journey? How did he do that?
He went through, like many people, cycle after cycle of recovery. So he'd go to that story where I'm calling from is really very much about one of his passes through recovery. And that one, they used to do a thing called, they'd give them Hummers, which were progressively more and more diluted shots of Rock Up bourbon. So you'd slowly be detoxing. He'd get out and he'd go straight back out and start drinking again. And then he sold a novel, which he never wrote. But there was something about that, I think, something about the sense of being believed in, people wanting him, some sort of confirmation that was that mysterious moment, I guess, in which somebody thinks, hang on, I can be better than this. Mm-hmm. And then he just went cold turkey. He just stopped. He got himself a little house in, I think it's McKinley in California, and hid away from people and just got his life slowly back on. And his last decade, he went to live out west. He was with Tess Gallagher, the poet, then. And he lived in this extraordinary landscape, which I visit in the book. And he was very clear that that landscape helped him, nourished him through his recovery, that it was giving him back some sense of integrity and goodness that is really there in his late poems and his late stories as well, that they're a lot more generous, a lot more concerned with redemption than his early work was.
And there's a lot of landscape in this book, of course, because you're taking, in addition to traveling back into these authors' lives, you're taking an actual physical journey across the United States. How did you plan your itinerary, and what exactly were you looking for? I'm just curious.
Well, I wanted it to be basically, I wanted the book to follow this sort of journey through alcoholism, so starting with very kind of intoxicating early stages, then looking at really the consequences of alcoholism, what happens when it gets really bad, that led through sort of the deaths, the suicides, and then out to redemption. And then I kind of plotted that on a map of America through places where these guys had lived, where they'd done their drinking, and used that physical journey. And the reason I did that is because landscape was so important to all of them. They were all very sensitive to it, very acute in their writing about it. And it seemed to play a part in the better elements of their lives. And it was very important to me while writing this that while I was dealing with these distressing stories, dark stories, that I never lost sight of how extraordinary they were as well, because I think otherwise it would have been a very different sort of book and not one that I would have been comfortable writing at all. So the landscape seemed to be a way into seeing something that was purer about them, I think.
Mm-hmm. And actually, even in some of those early Cheever stories you were talking about, where he's in the grip of something terrible as he's writing, he still can describe landscape with such exquisite beauty, and it shows that there was just something beyond the horizon of his prison that he could still access.
Yeah, and I think it's so important to not forget that capacity for beauty, for recognizing beauty, is there in all of them. And if you lose that, I think you lose their humanity.
Well, it's a great book. Highly recommended. I've been speaking with Olivia Lang about The Trip to Echo Spring on Writers and Drinking. It's published by Picador. And she will be in conversation with Rachel Syme on Thursday night at 7 at the 92nd Street Y. For more information, visit our show page. Olivia, thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.